You know, I am really here to pay a debt. And really, you know, it's a debt that I can't repay. And I hate it that Walt walked out of the room, but he did. But 25 years ago, Gail Jackson called me and asked me to join him in a Bible study on 1 Timothy. And we met at 5 a.m. to 9 a.m. and did heavy-duty inductive study. And Gail has poured into my life over the years in so many ways. I'm not just talking about Bible knowledge. I'm talking about helping me think biblically about my work, about my family, about my ministry. And Walt, too. Walt, I'm actually Walt's beloved disciple. I don't know if you know that or not, but Walt used to fly from San Diego to Atlanta for 10 years, every single month except for the summer, and to meet with a group of us, and took us through Romans and 1st and 2nd Corinthians and Hebrews. And I'm telling you, that has been absolutely foundational for my growth. But anyway, Walt would fly and meet me there. And that's, if he really loved you, he would do the same for you. I guess I'm special. I don't know. That's what my mama always told me. Yeah. Okay. So we're going to talk about the book of Daniel. And by the way, what's that? Exactly. Exactly. By the way, most of the guys in this room really, frankly, are a product of that man and that man's ministry, Walt and Gail. In some way, they've touched each of us who are reaching out to others. And so I'm here because I'm trying to repay a debt that will take the rest of my life to repay, how these two guys and a couple others poured into me, gave to me, and there's a couple of you nodding your heads, you know what I'm talking about. I've got to repay it. I didn't deserve it, and I come with a heart of gratitude, and I'm so thrilled to see so many guys coming over the weekend to spend time with God and trying to dig from the well a little bit. Well, we're going to chat on the book of Daniel this morning, and so we'll just jump right in. I want to give you context for the book of Daniel. In fact, we'll just sort of let you see how it fits into the Old Testament. The Old Testament really consists of three different kinds of books: historical books, poetical books, and prophetical books. So if you're in the Old Testament, you're reading one of these three types. And the way the Old Testament story goes, as Jay related some yesterday, is you've got 11 books that carry the storyline. So if you really want to read through the Old Testament, my suggestion is you start with these 11 books, because all the rest of the books hang on these 11. Can you see this? Genesis? No? Okay. I did it small so you couldn't check me. But Genesis, Exodus, Numbers, Joshua, Judges, 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, 1 Kings, 2 Kings, Ezra, and Nehemiah. That's the storyline of the Old Testament. It's just in those 11 books. So that means that Leviticus, Deuteronomy, Ruth, 1 Chronicles, 2 Chronicles, Esther all hang off of that story, as do the poetical books, the five poetical books. Tonight, my buddy Hank Miltenberger going to be presenting on the book of Job. And I think he's the funniest man I've ever met. I'm expecting some serious good Cajun jokes tonight. No pressure. Yeah, no pressure. And then we have the prophetical books. So the prophetical books are divided into the minor prophets and the major prophets. And the only difference between those two is the minor prophets were more brief. The major prophets were more verbose. And they're divided along this timeline of exile in Babylon, which we're going to talk about. And so Daniel fits in here after the book of 2 Kings, exile in Babylon. So to catch you up for where we were with Winston last night, He took you into the book of Joshua. And Joshua, unfortunately, did not learn from Moses one particular thing, and that's to train up a successor like himself. So Israel goes into a bit of chaos into the time of Judges. And then in the book of 1 and 2 Samuel, Israel says, we've got to have a king. And God says to him, well, I'm your king. And they said, well, we need a king like the other pagan nations around us. That would be really good. And God says to him, no, that's going to be bad for you. Your children are going to be enslaved. You're going to be taxed. Your property is going to be taken. And they say, so? We want a king. So God, in his graciousness, gives them a king. And we see that Saul coming along and the story of David in 1 and 2 Samuel. Then we move into kings. We see the succession of kings, the first king being Saul, then David, then Solomon. And Solomon's son, Rehoboam, was a crummy king. And under him, Israel split into two groups, the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. There were 10 tribes up in the northern kingdom, two in the southern, Benjamin and Judah. Sometimes the southern is called Judah. Well, through all these prophets, God warns Israel and warns Judah about obey, obey, obey. Make sure you obey. This is in your best interest. I'm not telling you this because I'm an oppressive tyrant. I'm telling you because it's in your best interest. Obey. Or bad things are going to happen. I'm going to deport you. They say, oh, sure you will. Sure you will. Well, indeed, in 722 B.C., God takes the northern kingdoms by force by the Assyrians and deports all of them up into Assyria. So that leaves Israel vacant except for the two southern tribes, Judah and Benjamin. And through the prophets, God tells them and their kings, you need to obey, do what I say, I love you, I want to have a relationship with you, just obey me. And they say, we don't think so. We want to do what we want to do. And God says, I'm going to deport you. I'm going to use a pagan nation. And indeed, that's what he did. In 586 B.C., King Nebuchadnezzar from Babylon comes along and he attacks Israel, or Judah, and destroys the temple and takes those people captive. So that's where we are in the book of Daniel. The other two books, Ezra and Nehemiah, are written after the exile. That's why they're called post-exilic, meaning after the exile, where Ezra and Nehemiah and Zerubbabel lead returns from Babylon or Persia back into Jerusalem to rebuild the temple. Okay, so far so good. Quick history. I promise the print won't be that small for the rest of the time. This is a picture of the Ishtar Gate in Babylon. We have a couple guys here that served in Iraq. Raise your hand if you served in Iraq. We have one guy. Okay. And you told me this morning you didn't get to see this. No. Okay. Well, Babylon, obviously, is located in Iraq. And if you remember, Saddam Hussein built a palace overlooking the ruins of Babylon because he considered himself to be a modern-day fancied himself a modern-day Nebuchadnezzar. Well, this is an artist portrayal from the 30s of what the Ishtar Gate looked like in Babylon. And if you'll note, right along the walls here, there are these brick ceramic glazed lions. And these lions lined the wall of the Ishtar Gate. So all the exiles, including Daniel, saw these very lions. And let me tell you, the edifice of Babylon, with the size of this fortress, as the world's greatest empire, was incredibly imposing. In fact, these lions were probably very fearsome, at least to little kids. So you can actually see these lions in the Pergamon Museum in Berlin. My little brother Johnny went with me and took this picture back when I was a little skinnier and healthier. My hair still looks good, though. Yeah. See, Walt's gonna wow you with substance. I'm gonna wow you with style. All right. I'm smart enough to change the rules in my favor. These are the actual lions that Daniel passed by, and all the exiles. By the way, one of the criticisms of the archaeologists at the time is, oh, the Bible's not true because there's no mention of King Nebuchadnezzar. We find nothing in archaeology that gives us any indication that he was there. The Bible's erroneous. Well, in the early 1900s, the Germans wanted to build a railroad to Iraq, and they did some excavations, and what did they find? They found these lions preserved like this. You see, this is a reconstruction. Here's new stuff. All the cracked stuff is the original. Not only did they find the lions of the Ishtar Gate, they found Nebuchadnezzar's throne, which has his name all over it, and different little cylinders that have Nebuchadnezzar's name on it. Again, affirming the veracity of the Bible. So let's look at the book of Daniel itself. It's pretty simple in its overall structure, just two parts. There's a history part, and it consists of six chapters. Won't go into each of those in detail for this purpose, but the other half is all about prophecy. You know, here you've got, and it consists of six chapters. For our purposes today, we're only going to be covering these top six. But the book is one of the top two or three, maybe four books in the entire Bible for understanding eschatology, meaning what happens in the end times. Because here you've got Israel that is supposed to be the chosen nation. And, you know, God was with them by a pillar of fire by night and a cloud by day. And yet he has his people brutally punished and deported off to this pagan nation. And it begs the question at this time, what about Israel? What about the Jews? What's God going to do? And it's in this book that God reveals his plans on that. And we're not going to get into the complexities of that today, although I'd love to. It's fascinating stuff about the consummation of human history, how God is moving history forward. And he makes predictions in here by name of some nations, for example, that are succeeding empires. He talks about the fall of Babylon being conquered by the Greeks, and the Greeks will be conquered by the Romans. And then in the future, there'll be a future Roman Empire that God will conquer in the end times, that Christ will conquer and then rule for 1,000 years. But we won't get into that. We're just covering the light stuff, which is the fun stuff. It's some of the greatest Bible stories, Daniel in the lion's den, the fiery furnace, etc. So these are good stories to know. I commend to you tonight, if you can, to try to read these six chapters. Quick read, and it's good stuff. So we're gonna just take 10 life lessons from the book of Daniel. If you need to ask clarifying questions or if I misspeak, holler at me. I hope to have some time for questions at the end. And will you watch me on time? Give me a 20-minute warning and a 15. Thanks. Okay, so here's the first one. The first life lesson is that God uses weakness for his glory. And before you just go, sure, yeah, I know that. Let's just think about this for a second. We see in the book of Daniel, in the first chapter, God takes four lads. I like to call them lads. Four little teenagers. These aren't old men with tons of experience with God. These are young guys that God chooses to use. They are probably the youngest examples in the scriptures of men who God used mightily. As far as I can tell, God puts them through severe trial. Just the march from Jerusalem, the 900-mile march from Jerusalem to Babylon, they would have seen tons of people die in its rigor. Not only that, but God put them with, Nebuchadnezzar lumped these four guys with the wise men and the magicians, and they had to deal with spiritual warfare going on. So, you know, God uses these very, what's the word? You wouldn't expect him to use this kind of weakness for young kids. You know, he does this in other places. Asks Aaron to speak to Pharaoh. Here's a stuttering guy. It seems to me that it's almost cruel to ask a stuttering guy to be your spokesman, but that's what he does. Or he takes Gideon's army that was 32,000 people strong and pares it down to 300. He loves to use weakness. Or he takes a shepherd boy, David, as Winston was talking about last night. I mean, imagine if we're in a war, the United States, and we've got our Delta Force, we've got our Green Berets, we've got our Navy SEALs, and they're all facing an enemy, and everybody's scared to death of him. And some kid that's not even a soldier walks up and says, who is this defying the armies of the living God? I mean, this is an incredible, incredible scene. But a little shepherd boy God takes and uses. And in the New Testament, he takes ignorant fishermen and uses them as the core who will spread his gospel worldwide. Paul says that my grace being God's, is sufficient for you. My power is perfected in weakness. Most gladly, therefore, will I boast about my weakness. You see the theme here, the repetition? That the power of Christ may dwell in me. He's boasting about his weakness. So never, the point here is to never underestimate how God can use it in you and in other people's lives. Brad, I need you to pay a little more attention. Second Corinthians 12:9. Thank you. All right. So, and here I'm just at my crescendo. Yeah. So, you may say, well, God's not going to use me. I'm not smart enough. I'm not a Bible scholar. I'm not like Walt. Oh, my gosh. You know, I'll never be like Walt. Or I just don't have courage. I'm timid. God can't use me. Or I'm not in the right economic bracket. Or, I mean, you name whatever it is that you feel is you're insecure about, and God can use it. I'm nervous about being up here. There's a sense, and I mean, I'm trembling to some extent being up here, but God's using me. So, what's going on here? So that's the point. Questions on that? I'm only going to take questions on that one because I'm really stalling for time right now. How does it apply to you? If you think that whatever weakness you have, intellectual, physical, Joni Erickson here is ministering to people and the woman's paralyzed. Whatever you think it is that's your weakness, don't underestimate how God can use you. He can use you through your weakness. That's the point. Was that satisfying, Gail? Okay. Mildly. Okay. Let's go to the next one. 2nd thing was, hey, I'm doing this for free, okay? What do you expect? Daniel bloomed where he was planted. When we look at Daniel shoved in with the Babylonians as a teenager, the wise men and the magicians, I mean, you have an idea of what these people are like when you see in the plagues of Egypt. These guys were able to do amazing things. These are the dark arts. And so he's thrown in with these guys. Good. We do have one senior in high school here, don't we? You're a senior?
Two.
You're a sophomore? We have two. Yeah, okay, good. Yeah, we're talking about lads your age doing stuff Amazing stuff. Well, Daniel shared very little with the Babylonians when you consider it. Theologically, they're pagan. Morally, culturally, politically, educationally, socially, they had completely different literature. The four lads were schooled in the language and the literature of the Babylonians, which means they learned cuneiform. They learned the thinking of the Babylonians. They probably read the Gilgamesh epic. Anybody read the Gilgamesh epic in here? Okay, there's one educated person here. No, no, which is, what's the Gilgamesh epic? Okay, do you remember what it was about? Okay. Huh? It was. Thank you, Jason McNeil. Yes. It's the Babylonian account of a worldwide flood. So, and you can find that at the British Museum. There's an archaeological artifact that has that story on it. In some way, it comports with our flood story. In some ways, it doesn't. But anyway, they're trained. They're brainwashed. This is essentially a brainwashed 3-year university that the boys are going to. Has nothing in common with these guys, and yet he thrives in their pagan culture. I mean, imagine you being deported. No, imagine Mr. Sophomore right there and Mr. Senior in high school being deported down to Venezuela and having to work in a regime that's completely opposite of what they know, and they don't even know the language, and yet they thrive. That's what the boys did. So they bloomed where they were planted. The point here is that spirituality can flourish in a hostile environment. I'm sure they were not well liked. I'm sure they were looked down upon. They were slaves. They were conquered slaves. And surely the Babylonian gods were greater, Marduk, for example, than Yahweh, because look, Marduk conquered Yahweh. But it can flourish in a hostile environment, as Daniel did. Some of us in Christendom have this fortress mentality about the culture. Let's circle the wagons. Let's just only do stuff with the holy huddle, with the Christians, and we'll interact with the culture by throwing gospel grenades over the wall. But we don't want to be with those filthy, dirty pagans because they do the nasty nine and the dirty dozen, and I'm trying to be holy, so I ain't going to hang around with them. And so it's kind of like what the Amish do. They don't interact with the rest of the culture. They just stay together. This is certainly not Daniel's approach, and it's not the approach Jesus took. Hanging out with the tax collectors and the whores and the sinners. So the question for you and I is, are you and I blooming where God has planted you? Is there discontent where God has planted you? I know a number of guys I've talked to have said, well, I just need to work for a Christian company. Because if I worked for a Christian company instead of for these pagans, you know, then our value systems would be in line and everything would be great. Of course, then they find out that there's sinners in the Christian company too. And that combined with the fact that their expectations were ratcheted so high, they come away very disappointed. Bob? How do you know? That's an excellent question for Dr. Walt Henriksen. There's really nothing else to say on that. No. Jeff?
Bill, would you back up 2 slides? I want to tell you the thing that went through my mind as you.
All right. Yeah. Here?
No, one more.
Okay.
One is a hostile environment.
Okay.
No, I'm sorry. I just went back to the floor. Okay, right there. Okay. Mm-hmm.
I'll make a quick comment on that, Jeff. I've had some dear friends where this issue of should we public school our kids and let them be witnesses for Christ, or should we pull them to Christian school, has caused great division in our relationship, huge division. And all I can say is, on the one hand, there's the thinking that why would you even consider letting Philistines educate your children and shape their life and worldview. So you have that on the one hand, and you have Daniel on the other hand. So it's up to you where you put your kids there, and I'm not sure there's a right or wrong answer. There's convictions and there's preferences, but that's between you and God. I've seen kids go to the public school and be very successful if they're smart kids and they get put in the upper echelon and have good teachers. And I've also seen kids absolutely tube out. So, anyway.
These two guys down here at the end of the table talked to them for a little bit.
Are they in Christian education?
No. They flourished in a hostile environment.
Very good. Okay, fair enough. Yeah, I'm not really looking for comments here. No, go ahead. Go ahead. But you're the last one.
Okay. My son went to a Christian school, and if you think that's not a hostile environment, then it's just as hostile.
Yeah, if you think it's a pure, holy environment among the kids, it depends. Yep.
And you have young people who have a profession of faith, but yet, you know, God's got their hand on them. He's the one who started it. He's going to finish it. But, you know, how do you work that out even as you disciple? I mean, I'm just talking about another person in my home that's a young disciple.
Yeah.
You know, so I know this is a team, but we can stop talking about it.
Yeah, Jeff, I'm not really interested in practical applications here. I'm just trying to get through the material. So, would you speak to this poor man's question when you do your thing tomorrow? No. Do you have anything you'd like to say about that, Walt? That's a reasonable question. All right. Moving on. You know, Walt just has a way of cutting through the fog. Next application from Daniel's life that comes out of, or from the book of Daniel. This comes out of chapter 3. And in chapter 3, Daniel is completely absent. We don't know where he is. He could be off in the kingdom doing business, but he's nowhere to be found. And the point here is that the results of civil disobedience can be positive or negative. Now, what do we mean by civil disobedience? I'm asking.
Disobeying the local
authorities. Okay, disobeying them. Very good. Okay? So we look here, and the lads knew. Here was the deal. What Nebuchadnezzar did, as any good pagan king would do, is set up. You've got to get your picture out there. You've got to make yourself present and powerful. That's why they put their picture on coins. But what Nebuchadnezzar did what Nebuchadnezzar did is built a statue of himself, 90 feet tall. It could have been of himself, but it was a statue. Probably was of himself, 90 feet high, all gold. And the deal was when you play, when he played the music or when he had the music ordered or whenever the music played, you were to bow down and to worship the statue. And like musical chairs, when the music stops or when the music's, well, it's kind of the inverse of musical chairs, but you get the idea. Well, the boys wouldn't do that. They would not bow down and worship this statue. And they knew that the penalty was being burned alive by fire. So they chose to disobey. We see this also in Acts with Peter and the apostles. Peter said, we must obey God rather than men, because the civil authority was saying, don't talk about Jesus. They're choosing to be civilly disobedient here. Also, Paul tells us in Romans 12, 2, to be conformed to this world and not to be conformed to this world, but to be transformed by the renewing of your mind. So we're not looking for absolute conformity to this world. That's not what God wants us to do. But here are the boys, and they have no guarantee of protection from God. God didn't say, guys, go through this, and I'm going to take you through it. It's going to be no problem. You will, actually, your skin will be fireproof. Your skin and your hair, it's going to be no problem. They didn't have any guarantee of this. In fact, here's what they said to a furious Nebuchadnezzar, who essentially has given him a chance to repent. He said, these boys say back to him, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But even if he does not, because they're not sure, let it be known to you, O king, we are not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. So, again, this is clear civil disobedience. And, you know, God didn't obligate himself in any way to save these boys, nor does he obligate himself to save us from any of our particular trials. He did not give them any promise of ease, nor us. And he's not a genie where we just rub him like Aladdin lamp and or a celestial Coke machine where we put the quarter in and we expect, you know, or we put the dollar in and we expect the Coke out. As Winston pointed out last night, we serve him, he doesn't serve us. So here the boys could have half bowed, or they could have made some concession, thinking, you know, it's better we stay alive because look how we're influencing the kingdom. Maybe we'll come in power. They didn't. They deliberately chose not to do this act of allegiance. So this begs the question, what are you and I willing to die for? It is. You know, there's another slide here, I think. Hang on just a second. This is a quick technical difficulty. Yep.
Would you say the only justification we have for civil disobedience, since we're supposed to be in subjection to the authority of God to serve us, is when it is against the commandments of God?
Repeat the question, please.
So, you know, we're supposed to be in subjection to the authorities of God to serve us.
Right. Right.
Are there other places where there's...
Not that I'm aware of. We disobey the governments when their laws are in conflict with the law of God. God is our authority. He's the one that gives us our marching orders. Now, that doesn't mean that we won't obey the civil authorities where God doesn't speak to that. We're still required to obey the civil authorities according to Romans 13. But the civil obedience occurs when they're telling us to do something that God forbids. Okay, let's move on to the next one. And if I find that slide I'm looking for, I will. This begs the question of what we're willing to die for, because the boys are willing to die for this, these lads. So Daniel in chapter 6 gets set up by the Persians. They don't like the fact that he's a foreigner and he's in the high places in the government, so they want to set him up and make him fall. What do? They con King Darius, king of the Persians, to make a law that says if anybody prays to anybody but you, King Darius, let him be executed. Daniel is completely aware of this law, and as is his custom, what does he do? He goes out on his porch or wherever it is that he prayed, that people obviously saw him pray 3 times a day, and continues in his practice. So he was willing to be executed for his freedom to pray. Mordecai, in the book of Esther, we see a similar thing. You've got Haman, who serves under King Xerxes. He's a top dog, and he's on a power trip, and he loves when people bow to him. And he walks out, and Mordecai the Jew doesn't bow to him, and this ticks him off. I mean, it infuriates him. So he goes and builds a massive gallows that very night. Oh, you won't bow to me? No problem. You're a marked man, and your life's going to be over tomorrow. Well, Mordecai knows he's in exile. He's under the Persian nation. He knows what the rules are. He knows how to play the game. But he chooses not to bow to the man. I don't know if this will ever happen in the United States. It very well may, where we're required to bow to something or pledge allegiance to something that is other than God, as the Christians had to do during the Roman time. Jesus is Lord. They had to say Caesar is Lord. Yeah.
Do you think that the other Jews who did go ahead and bow to Haman, do you think that they were in sin?
Yes, I do. Okay. We see also Stephen in the book of Acts, in Acts 7, he's sharing the gospel with hostile Jews. He continues to share it, and they stone him for it. And then, of course, Paul, in his preaching of the gospel, let's see what happens with him. We look here at in Corinthians. He says, 3 times I was beaten with rods. Imagine that, being beaten with rods almost to death. Once I was stoned. Once I was shipwrecked. A night and a day I have spent in the deep. The man has been through terrifying experiences. I've been on frequent journeys, in dangers from rivers, from robbers, from my countrymen, from the Gentiles, dangers in the city, dangers in the wilderness, dangers on the sea, dangers among false brethren. But he's willing to put up with this. He's willing to die for these things. Now, the difference between Daniel and Mordecai is that God delivered them through their trials. The difference between Stephen and Paul is God chose not to take them out of their trials. And Stephen, of course, was stoned and killed, and Paul was beheaded outside of Rome. So, though this is an uncomfortable question, it is for me. What am I really willing to die for? I mean, really, truly. Where would I make a final stand? And am I willing to trust God to the death? These are what some of our examples in the faith have done, and many, many, many since. So this is one of the questions that the book of Daniel raises. Fifth life lesson is don't allow the circumstances of life to determine your view of either truth or God's character. Again, don't allow circumstance to determine your view of truth or God's character. And the reason is that you can't do this, that you can't look at the your circumstances of your life and determine if God's pleased with you or not pleased with you, depending on whether you're prospering or in trial. Is that circumstance just simply isn't reliable. And to illustrate this, I have gone to the height of culture and pulled a clip from Hee Haw from the 70s to illustrate this fact.
Come on in, come down, grab a seat.
I will stoop to no levels to. So the point here in this funny interchange with these guys is that circumstance just isn't a reliable indicator. You say, well, oh, you know, God bless me. I sold my company and I made $3, $4, $5 million. Well, that's good. Well, I don't know. It might be bad. You might go out and get yourself a Ferrari and start attracting sweet little things and decide that you've met your soulmate or you deserve that and you break up your family. You know, so was the money good? It might be good. It might be bad. I don't know. So you can't tell from prosperity or the lack thereof whether the circumstances are good or bad. In fact, Malcolm Muggeridge said that in his 90 years, most of the most important lessons that he learned were those he learned during trials and pain over his entire life. So are the circumstances good or bad? I don't know. They are what they are.
Are you saying that there's not necessarily a blessing?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. And they're not necessarily a indicator of God's favor. Let me illustrate it from the scriptures. You look at Daniel. Here's a guy that has served successfully under the Babylonian regime in amazing ways that God has absolutely used. He's been deported. Probably some or much of his family's dead. I mean, you talk about a guy that served God. He gets promoted in the next empire. The Medes and the Persians conquer the Babylonians, so he's in the Persian Empire. The Persians falsely accuse him, set him up. Well, yeah, he was praying, okay, to Yahweh instead of King Darius. But they throw him in this lion's den that probably just reeks of urine and feces, rotted flesh. He may see parts of people that he know and watch get thrown down there. And he's down there with those lions. And I'm telling you, I could really get an attitude down there with God. You know? Do I deserve this? Is this what I get? You know, the same with Joseph. He's rotting there in the cell in Egypt, full of roaches and rats, and betrayed by his brothers, mistreated, and he's in prison, for heaven's sake, for being falsely accused by Potiphar because he had an adulterous wife that was hitting on him. And then he tells the baker about. He interprets the baker's dream, does him a favor, and says, hey, baker, throw me a bone, and the baker forgets about him. He could have some serious attitude. God, where are you? Where are you? You're nowhere. Like the pop, there's a pop singer, I won't mention her name, you won't know her, who wrote a song that said, God, you just don't seem to come through. Do you need a woman to look after you? And Tori Amos, yes, in fact. And that's where that kind of thinking comes from. He's some celestial vending machine, and he owes us. You look at Paul and his imprisonment. Was God's favor on him? Absolutely. In those trials, yes. But could he look at his circumstances and say that they indicated God's favor? No. Same with the Hebrews 11 martyrs. If any of them looked at their circumstances and said, my circumstances prove that God's happy with me or that God is good, you wouldn't find that evidence. We see this today with the entitlement mentality that many have, the prosperity gospel that says in whatever form, God wants you rich, he wants you healthy, and the prayer of Jabez. Remember that fad from a few years ago? Which is basically a light form of the prosperity gospel. These things all create false expectations, and they can shipwreck our faith because God doesn't obligate him to these things in the New Testament. In the Old Testament, God promised blessings for obedience to the gathered nation of Israel under the theocracy of God, where God was the guy in control. In the New Testament, it's a completely different covenant where Israel is scattered and the church has Gentiles in it, and you have the Holy Spirit. It's a completely different system. As Walt has pointed out, the thing that God promises in the New Testament is that the godly in Christ Jesus will be persecuted. It's not a tit-for-tat obedience game in the New Testament. So this is James's take on it. Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials. Which, I'll tell you, I've thought about this verse for 20 years, and man, I struggle with it. But I do know this. Often the natural realm mirrors the spiritual realm. Just as I need resistance and weightlifting in the gym to build my physical muscles, so also in the spiritual realm do I need this resistance of life to help build my faith. And that's why he gives it to us. He says this also in Romans 5:3. This is how we're supposed to look at the doo-doo that comes our way. Or what we think is doo-doo. It might not be doo-doo. It might be great. That we exult in our tribulation, knowing that tribulation brings about perseverance. It builds strength. Next lesson in Daniel, the book of Daniel, is it time to step up? As I mentioned earlier, in the fiery furnace scene, Daniel was absent. We don't know where he was. Very likely in another part of the kingdom on business. But the lads had to face this trial without their leader, without their mentor with them. So the question is it time for you and I to step up? Excuse me. Let me give you a little parallel. Henry Nouwen wrote a book called The Return of the Prodigal Son. Have any read that book in here? A few of you had. He's really one of my favorite Catholic authors. And he saw a reproduction of this painting by Rembrandt that sits at the Hermitage in St. Petersburg, Russia. And he wrote an entire book about this painting and about the parable about the prodigal son. And essentially in it, one of the points that he makes that was really meaningful to me was that all of us at some point in our lives need to step up and be the father. A father in the later stages of life when your friends may be dead, your extended family's dead, you're it. You're the next one ready to go over the cliff, if you will. You're the next one in line for death. The point isn't about death. The point is about taking the responsibility where you've got to step up. It's your turn to be the strong one. Without any support from the brothers, it's your turn to walk with God all alone and trust Him and give encouragement where there isn't any, give hope where there isn't any, give love where there isn't any, give truth where there isn't any, all alone. Is this a point in your life where God's asking you to step up to some degree? Maybe not all the way to fatherhood, but is there something He's asking you to do that's tough and it's lonely and there's nobody to give you affirmation around you, but you know you've got to walk through it alone? I know my little brother, 3 weeks ago, his 32-year-old wife died of breast cancer. Two kids, 2 years old and 4 years old. And, you know, as much as my heart bled for my little brother, excuse me, I couldn't take the pain away, and I couldn't walk through this with him. I can walk alongside, but I couldn't. He lives in Austin, and you know, there's only so much support I can give him. He's going to have to walk through this alone. It's really tested his faith and caused his faith to grow, as horrible as it is. Brad? Yeah, go ahead. I won't bite you this time.
As I was actually driving down here, I was listening to the biography of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And as he's in America preparing to go back into the heat of Nazi Germany, he's safe and he chooses to go back. He is actually concerned because he knows he's about to have to do what you just described. Mm. He's going to have to step up and be alone and not have the support of his brother. And he knows it could be years. He's actively preparing for that time. And he has a mentor who's already been in the concentration camp for 2 years at this point, and that man ends up being alone for 8 years, and
Yeah. Yeah, great illustration. Thank you. 20 minutes? Really? 20 minutes? Okay. All right. So the next 20 minutes. Man. This seems like 10 to me. Does it seem like about 3 hours to you all? I don't know. Daniel sought the best interest of his captor. As he served under Nebuchadnezzar, God gave Nebuchadnezzar two disturbing dreams. The second one comes out of Daniel 4, chapter 4, where God gives Nebuchadnezzar a dream about a big, beautiful tree offering shade for the creatures around it and coming perched in it, etc. And someone comes and chops down this tree and puts a band of copper around it. And he wants to know, he wants that dream interpreted. Of course, his wise men can't interpret it. Daniel interprets it. And here's what Daniel says. Oh, no, this isn't what Daniel said. This is what happened. What Daniel said to him was, the tree is a symbol of you and the empire of Babylon, and it's about to be cut down. But nevertheless, you're going to survive it, but God's going to chop it down. So here's actually what happened. When Nebuchadnezzar was looking over Babylon, his heart became filled with pride. You should know, by the way, that, let me just go back here for a second, that Babylon contained the Hanging Gardens, which we don't have any, we don't know what they looked like, but they were considered to be one of the seven wonders of the world. And, I mean, this man is in charge of the greatest empire in the world. He's conquered everyone. They are the top dogs. Nebuchadnezzar was an incredible architect and builder, and he looks over this kingdom that he's got, and his heart gets filled with pride. And here's what happens. Immediately, the word concerning Nebuchadnezzar was fulfilled, and he was driven away from mankind and began eating grass like cattle. And his body was drenched with the dew of heaven until his hair had grown like eagle's feathers and his nails like bird claws. This is weird. Well, in 1795, William Blake painted this portrait of what he thought Nebuchadnezzar probably looked like. And in the early 40s, in Britain, they identified a disease called boanthropy, where a person fancies themselves as a cow and they just eat grass. Of course, they fed him water as well, but this is probably a period of 7 years of madness that Nebuchadnezzar went through. Year one, Daniel sought his best interest. Year two, his best interest. Year three, he's looking out the castle, and there's old Nebuchadnezzar eating the grass like a flipping crazy man. But Daniel kept his kingdom together and waited. Year four, he kept the kingdom, waited. Year five, waited. Year six, he kept Nebuchadnezzar's best interest. And we're talking about a man who, well, we'll show you here in a second. The amazing thing to me is that you have a victim, so-called victim, Daniel, who's been deported to this pagan kingdom, and he loves his enemy in this way, where the prey trusts the predator, the slave becomes master, and then when Nebuchadnezzar is restored and repents, he goes back to slave. This is amazing, amazing trust in the sovereignty of God. And it begs the question to us, how do you and I respond when we get the shaft? Do we serve in the best interest of someone who's given us the shaft, either in business or my wife's insults or a friend's insults? Do we look after their best interest? Do we forgive? Do we love? Etc. Jesus said, of course, I say to you, love your enemies, which is completely countercultural, counterintuitive, and takes supernatural power to do. If you're not close to Jesus, if you haven't developed an intimate relationship with him, there's no way you're going to love your enemies. We just want to kill our enemies. Let me give one last application, then we'll have a couple of comments. Let's jump to the 10th one for time. Sometimes God delivers us from a trial. We see in Daniel 1, Nebuchadnezzar is upset because he's had this dream and he wants it interpreted. Not only does he want it interpreted, he wants the magicians and his wise men to tell him what the dream is. I mean, after all, if you're connected with the gods, you ought to know, right? Well, they say, oh, this is unreasonable. You shouldn't ask us to do something like this. Only someone who is totally connected with the gods could know this. And Nebuchadnezzar answers back to him, essentially, I'm tired of your hypocrisy. I'm tired of your stalling. I want all of you dead. You're worthless. You're basically making stuff up. Well, little Daniel says, I think I can interpret the dream. And so he does, and he does so successfully. So God does not make him go through that trial. He completely delivers, he deletes the trial so that Daniel doesn't have to go through it. So there's sometimes when God delivers from the trial where you don't have to endure it. It's like a Calgon take me away thing. God takes you away from the trial or he gets rid of the trial. So you will not have to endure it. And since you won't have to endure it, you'll survive it. On the other hand, there are times when God delivers us through a trial, which is the example of Daniel in the lion's den. He had no reason to believe that God would shut the mouths of those lions. And God didn't say, oh, I'm just kidding. You didn't have to go down to be with the lions. He made him go down there. He made him sit with them all night long, smell their breath, be in there, not knowing at any moment if anyone would attack him. And by the way, it wasn't that they weren't hungry, because when his enemies got thrown in there, his accusers, they were gobbled up on the way down. So this is true of the lads in the fire. God made him go through the fire. But the good news is they endured it and they survived it. So that's another option. God might deliver us through a trial. The last option is he might deliver us by the trial into the arms of Jesus. Paul said that he's experienced mockings, and Hebrews. These people experienced mockings and scourgings, yes, also chains and imprisonment. They were stoned, sawn in two, tempted, put to death with the sword. You don't have prosperity gospel preachers talking out of Hebrews 11 very often. These people, these martyrs, and the martyrs that are dying even this day in the Sudan or in China or wherever, God is delivering them into his arms. So in the case of being delivered by a trial, we will have to endure it, but we will not survive it. The good news is for those of us that have trusted Christ, and he's our Lord and our Master, he'll deliver us into his arms. I shared this, by the way, with one of the brothers, Dave Davidson, who has been to this conference. And he was in my Bible study for quite a number of years and developed brain cancer. And I remember taking him out to lunch one day, and we talked through this. He was begging for God to heal him, that God would deliver him through the trial. And we talked about the difference between from, through, and by. And he was actually encouraged by this. And the Lord took him 27 days later. So no matter what, God has our best interest at heart. And that's what I cling to, that he loves me and he has my best interest at heart. So, I won't sum up. I'll just ask for any questions and comments. How much time do we have? 10 minutes, okay. Yep.
Did you quickly give us 8 and 9?
Really? All right. God uses, I'll just go through them real quick. God uses weakness for his glory. Daniel bloomed where he was planted. Third one is the results of civil disobedience could be positive or negative. What are we willing to die for? Don't allow circumstance to determine your view of truth and God's character. It's completely unreliable. Six, is it time to step up? Is it time for me to move in that step of faith where I got to go where I don't want to go? Jesus in the garden, you talk about loneliness. Seven, Daniel sought the best interest of his captor. Eight is he overcame the temptation to usurp power. Let me tell you, if there was any guy that had reason to usurp power and to get revenge on this king, on this mad king out there eating grass, who's killed, who's desecrated his temple, who's destroyed his city, who's essentially destroyed his nation, destroyed and enslaved his nation. Daniel was probably castrated as well so that he wouldn't be a factor among the women in the Babylonian court. This guy had reason to say, I'm going to put it to this man. This is time. He's crazy and I'm in power. I'm taking this to the dome, you know? He didn't. And the reason he didn't was because his prophecy said that it would be for a period of seven times. So Daniel trusted God that God was going to do what he said when he said he did. And indeed he did. The next one that I really wish I could have gone into was that Daniel was a great example of lay ministry. He was not a priest. He was part of the royal family or nobility in Israel. He was not a Levite. And yet, look at the guy. He had the ability to interpret dreams, and he was a prophet. So God uses men like you and I in the business world. So that was that. Yeah. Oh, did I get? Yeah, and then God may deliver from through by. Yep.
It seems to me, would you agree that it has to do with how eternal a perspective you have on life? And if that is the case, then if you don't have that, how can we get it?
So your question is, I didn't understand your question. What is the it that you're referring to? To live the way Daniel, do you have an eternal perspective? You know, the scripture doesn't say why Daniel did what he did, but we knew he knew the scriptures. He was a prophet, etc. You can assume that he feared the Lord, and that's about all I can say. Whether his perspective was an eternal perspective, I don't want to comment because the scripture doesn't comment. As a general principle, would I say that's important? Completely important, I would. And that's why I need the constant infusion of truth, the word, each day, because I lose my perspective. I think this is all there is, and my circumstances are all there is, and the crappy deal I got is all there is. So, yeah, I do think that's important, Tom. Other comments or questions?
Yep.
Hey, don't go quiet on me now, because you... No, just kidding. Yes.
I think my tendency is, I would die for that, or I would die for this, but God gives me opportunities to die every day that I say yes to, and I also say no to. So I guess that's a comment, but, you know, he's preparing us in that.
He is, and I'd say that probably if I'm not dying in some of the little things, I'm not going to pass the big test, because he's who's faithful and little will also be faithful in much. Yeah,
I think
Mike.
One of the things that's important for us to remember is that God gives us the grace for the circumstance in which he places us. He doesn't give us grace for somebody else. Grace can't be stored up. It's like manna. It's every day, and it's day by day.
Yeah.
Now, it's interesting that Daniel was prepared for what
Yes, his grace was sufficient. Yeah, great point. Yeah, Billy. No, I'm not sure. I'm sorry. I'm not sure what you're asking me.
How is that applicable to me? So you said that we talk about Daniel, but I'm not, if I stand up for being a Christian,
yeah.
It's not like a death decision. So where is my application inside of being standing up for the courage?
Good question. Do you know, sometimes I find that I am... even praying in a restaurant, I'm embarrassed or aware of people. And, you know, on that level, about what other people are thinking about the fact that I'm praying. And I'm rebuked because I'm like, if I won't confess him before men, if I'm ashamed of him before men, what makes me think I'll stand the test of a trial where I might die? So I suppose it's it's more the little things that is the way I apply it. Does that make any sense? Yeah. It is. There are so many applications in the book of Daniel. It's for sure one of my favorite books in the Old Testament. And we're not even talking about the eschatology part, which is crazy wonderful. Yeah, you had a comment?
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up on that. What does it look like? You mentioned the small things, but even if there's a daily life that we deal with, there are always these days and temptations and the opportunities to take a shortcut. Those are two things that are not what.
Good. Yes, sir. Last one. Okay.
The small herd of sheep who died every day to their faith, Christian faith, and those numbers have been going up the last 40 years every year. So sometime maybe this could happen in this country very easily where we could actually die for our faith too.
It is. Yeah, it's not completely unthinkable that within 10 years, 15 years, the government turns particularly anti-Christian. Well, why would they do that? Well, because they're instituting hate crime laws, and any church that's teaching that homosexuality is wrong, and frankly, the Christians and the Muslims are the one who mostly teach this. So you got these hate crime laws, and so the government's putting watchdogs in our churches to watch what happens. And am I going to be willing to stand? Am I going to teach the word in its fullness if I've got to teach out of 1 Corinthians 6:9 or Romans 1? What will I do? Will I? Especially, I could rationalize it all kinds of ways too. I've got a family. I go to prison. What are they going to do to eat? Well, that's not good for them. I need to be the spiritual leader. So I could rationalize not doing it a lot of ways. But I don't think that's the way Daniel or the lads or Paul would have handled it. So it's not conceivable. It's not inconceivable that it's coming our way. Maybe way faster than we think. Thank you for your time, guys.